Return of the Jedi is an epic space adventure that concludes the original Star Wars trilogy in spectacular fashion. The movie opens with our heroes Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, and Han Solo on a daring mission to rescue Han from the clutches of the vile gangster Jabba the Hutt. With lightsabers blazing and blasters firing, they fight their way through Jabba's palace and ultimately destroy the slimy, slug-like creature. As the Rebel Alliance prepares for their final showdown with the evil Empire, Luke confronts his father, Darth Vader, in a thrilling lightsaber duel that will determine the fate of the galaxy. Meanwhile, Han and Leia lead a daring mission to disable the Empire's new Death Star before it can obliterate the Rebel Alliance. With heart-pumping action, stunning special effects, and unforgettable characters, Return of the Jedi is a triumphant conclusion to the original Star Wars trilogy that will leave audiences cheering.
Hello there, and welcome to this episode of It's How Old? I'm your host, Mark Asquith, and today on this episode, I'm going to be talking about one of the most pivotal movies in my own library. It is, of course, the 1983 Skywalker Saga epic Return of the Jedi. And it's going to be a fun show, actually, because, as you know, I'm the founder of Nerd Podcasts, where we include various shows that are pretty much all about Star Wars, including our flagship show, Spark of Rebellion. And if you listen to that show, you are absolutely 100% certain to know my co-host for this particular episode. I'm excited to dive in. We're going to talk about all things Return of the Jedi. We're going to talk about the ups, the downs. I'm going to get my co-host's thoughts and the score that they would have given it had they seen it back then when it first came out. And then we're going to dig into the cast. We're going to dig into the things that we loved that we might not have loved. We're going to dig into the music, and we're going to talk about all things Return of the Jedi. And then we're, of course, going to give our scores as if we'd walked out of the movie theater today and seen it, given everything that we've talked about and everything in Star Wars media that has come along since. If you're new to the show, welcome. This is season one, and there is no particular listening order. In fact, all you got to do is pick out a show, a movie that you enjoy the most. This season, we are covering, of course, Return of the Jedi, The Dark Knight, Superman, the movie, Man of Steel, and Jurassic Park. All weirdly scored by either John Williams or Hans Zimmer, which I had no idea when I picked those movies, and you can certainly see where my influence lies. So pick a movie and dig in, sit back and enjoy, because this is the show that we celebrate pop culture's biggest birthdays. Now let me bring on my fantastic co-host. I mentioned that obviously I work in podcasting and I'm part and founder of the Nerd Podcast Network, and pretty much every show that we do there, as I mentioned, is a Star Wars podcast, amongst other things, but generally speaking, pretty much Star Wars exclusively. This show is part of that, and I'm bringing on not only the co-host of the flagship show Spark of Rebellion, but my co-founder here at Nerd Podcast, one of the world's biggest Star Wars fans. It is Mr. Gary Ehlert. I feel like weird saying welcome to the show because we podcast every week about Star Wars, but this is a different podcast, so welcome to the show, dude.
Thank you very much, dude. This is a different vibe, for sure. We used to be in tail gunners on the old Spark of Rebellion and doing that sort of hosting week on, week off. So it feels weird, I must be honest, being a guest on one of your other podcasts. But dude, what a show. What a show this is. When you first mentioned this ages ago, like, dude, I've got this idea for a wicked podcast. And I was like, oh yeah, it's probably going to be a retroactive review. Like, no, slightly different. And as soon as you said the premise, I was like, this is badass. And the films that you've got in this first season, mate, absolutely, like, this is our childhood and teens, apart from probably The Dark Knight. I don't know how old we were for that one, but the rest of it, mate, is just pure, oh, you've picked some bangers here. So yeah, it's good to be on and chat this stuff, dude. Yeah, good show.
Well, good to have you, man. As always, it's always a good laugh. And yeah, do you know, it's weird when I was thinking of doing something like this for ages, it's normally like around the pub. You know, it's like, can you believe that's this old? I've just got another one now as we're recording this. So this is a labor of love. I don't blast this out like I do every other podcast that's a weekly thing. This is very much like taking a year to just sit down, and because there's a lot more prep work in this one. so this has taken a lot of prep work, and it's pretty much taken me like a year to get this from idea to launch, just because it's a bit of a laugh. So as we're recording this now, I'm aiming to put it out by the end of the year 2023 as a bit of a swan song for the year. But we're recording this now, 16th of August, and I've just, mate, that this is one for next year. We'll probably miss it, because I'm not going to do season two, but this year. But 30 years ago, Super Mario All-Stars was released today on the SNES. Can you believe that? That is where this idea from. Can you believe that? Holy crap.
30 years. Yeah. Bloody hell. Yeah. I think out of 100% for this show, the 1%, that's a little bit, oh, is that for guys like you and I, it does make you feel a bit old.
Yeah, right.
It's like, how, well, as the title, you know, the clue's in the name. It does make you feel, it's not just the show is that old, but it makes you feel like, crikey, that was like school holidays in your pajamas, you know, in the morning.
Yeah.
Not having to,
oh, it's man, that's that exactly
vibe.
It. Yeah. It really is, dude. And that, like, that's amazing, because I sort of thought to myself, right, I'm going to stick the Dark Knight in there, because that's pretty new. And then even then, I was, that is 15 years. And I thought, you have got to be absolutely kidding me right now. Right? That it's almost Return of the Jedi 40 years ago almost makes me feel less old than the Dark Knight 15 years ago, because it feels like it was about 15 minutes ago. Do you know what I mean? It's like this weird, time's a weird thing, isn't it?
Exactly the same, mate. And I had a similar conversation with my wife at the weekend. She was watching, I don't know which one it was, but one of the Pirates of the Caribbean films. To me, I thought that was like, I don't know, the last one was just a couple of years ago. And she was like, no, this is like 12 years or something. I'm like, get out of here. She's like, no, it's like 12, 13 years, this one. And it was, yeah, it's those ones that you think are a lot newer, they're the ones that make you feel really old. Just like The Dark Knight, that's crazy. 15 years.
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
It's nuts, man. It really is. And we see it with all sorts of things. Like this show is not just about movies. You know, I talk about it in the trailer, and this is very much about pop culture. It's very much about, you know, we'll get video games in there, which I'm sure we'll talk about in the future, because you're a big video game guy. We'll get music in there. Like, that freaks me out. Like, some of the Oasis stuff is coming up for 30 years next year. Definitely, maybe. And so it's, I think that's what's interesting, because we see, certainly this one, I picked movies because, you know, we can all remember movies. It's you know, we've all got our favorites, but I really want this to become sort of a music thing and a gaming thing, so I'm excited about doing a season two and a season three of this. But let's jump into Return of the Jedi, because this is a little bit different to the others, because I love, like, DC, that the Dark Knight, Man of Steel, Superman, they're all easy for me because I've seen them a billion times and I love them, and I love a DC. Jurassic Park is Jurassic Park, and it's badass. But Star Wars is a little bit different, man. We talk about Star Wars every single Saturday morning. We release an episode of Spark of Rebellion, recapping news, having a bit of banter about Star Wars. Like, we are deep in Star Wars. You know, I'd say for me, it was like DC and Star Wars. And obviously for you, it's sort of like the Doctor Who and Star Wars, which feel like, you know, they're the two big things. So we know with this one, like, it's a 40-year-old movie. But it's, like I said, I feel like this discussion will be a little bit different to the others, because there are reissues. And I know there are reissues of, like, Superman the movie. I've watched the director's cut and the TV cut of that, which are very, very different. But there are reissues. There are the Lucas edits. There are all the different versions of this. And then the perhaps the most interesting part of this for me, and I know you'll agree with this, is that Return of the Jedi 40 years ago marked the beginning of the dark times, where there was no other content until the Timothy Zahn books. But now, in 2023, as we're recording this, we're a week out from Ahsoka starting, which is going to pull from absolutely certainly element to Return of the Jedi, even if it's just the fact that Anakin's a Force ghost. So there's, like, this just feels different. So what I wanted to try and do to start with, right, is forget all of that stuff, because that's going to be difficult to forget. We watch Star Wars, we read Star Wars pretty much every single day. What I want to try and do is, let's take ourselves back and let's discuss the impact of Return of the Jedi back in the day. Now, can we remember it in 83? I just about can't. I don't think I can. I can remember it very young, and I'll talk about that in a second, but I'm not sure we can remember walking out of the theater for this one. So I want to talk about the impact that it's had on you, the impact that it's had on me to start with, and then I want to give it a score as if we'd just left the theater in 1983, not knowing anything else that we know about Star Wars now, having just seen A New Hope, Empire, and this. So, for you then, dude, like, what's the impact to Return of the Jedi? What's the impact to Return of the Jedi on you?
So, for me, this is one of the earliest memories I've got of science fiction, essentially. When I was three when this landed in the cinema. So, obviously, way too young to even remember anything about it on release. I remember watching this on, it was either Christmas Day or Boxing Day, a couple of years after that. It's one of my earliest memories, is one of the houses that we lived in when I was a wee lad. I think I was about six, I think, five or six. And Christmas Day had gone through the motions as it had done. And then I think it was late afternoon, early evening. I remember walking through the living room with one of my toys that I'd opened up, and it was on the TV in the living room. I don't think anybody had specifically put it on because my mum wasn't into that stuff, obviously, but it was just on in the background. And the very first image I have is the AT-AT doing laps around the base on Endor. I remember thinking, this is so vivid, it's really weird. I remember thinking, obviously not the language, but bloody hell, like, I just, what the hell is this? I remember sat down immediately, as I said earlier, sort of cross-legged, about a foot away from the TV, and just watching it till the end and thinking, Jesus, that was, and I'd never seen, outside of just cartoons that you watched as a kid, I'd never seen anything like that from live action, from a science fiction perspective. So that was the first time that I'd seen anything like that. And I think, like, my parents and my uncle and one of my elder half brothers at the time, I remember them very, very, not very vivid at all, but then watching things like the old Incredible Hulk series, that stuff, and just, but very on and off, not really paying much attention to it from a kind of science fiction-y fantasy point of view. So for me personally, this was the very first time I'd seen, like, Star Wars, like, special effects stuff, it happened to be in Star Wars. So for me onwards, that was the moment when it was all about Star Wars. Like, every Christmas and birthday, it's like, yeah, I want Star Wars figures, and all that stuff. And I wasn't aware of the dark times that came immediately after that, because, you're a kid and you just crack on with other stuff. And so, yeah, me personally, dude, first exposure to that stuff, and just weird timing as well, just because if I hadn't have walked through the living room that day, or if they didn't have it on the TV, I still would have watched it, obviously, at some point, but I wouldn't have absorbed it at that young age, I guess. Yeah.
Dude, that is so similar to me as well. That is so similar. So I was one when this came out. I'm a couple of years younger than you. Not that you can tell visually, but, whatever. I do work out a little bit. we'll put a video up. And it was... I was one. And this, I think you absolutely bulleted it when you said Boxing Day and Christmas, right? This was my first ever exposure to Star Wars. And as you say, science fiction. I was sort of, like, around this time, I was sort of like He-Man, Master of the Universe, like Mask classic, with the cars and the cartoons of like Centurions and all that. This is around that time. And it was, I probably saw this like 86-ish, when I was just about old enough to be thinking to myself, what is going on? And it's exactly the same thing. Like, the first thing I remember about this is Luke Skywalker in a black outfit. And I was like, who is that and what is he doing? And it was, I just remember, like, the throne room scene. It was so impressive to me. It was sort of like, I didn't even understand the gravity of the situation in context of the story. I just knew, like, something was going on, right? And this guy, even though he's all dressed in black, he's a good guy. And that old guy is clearly a Nautian. He's a baddie. And then the guy in between, I can't quite figure it out. Like, he looks like he should be a baddie, but then he seems to be looking after this other kid. And it was, So for me, it was sort of, I think it piqued my interest subconsciously around, you know, I like the whole mythology side of things and the connected nature things. I think it sort of started to stimulate that a little bit. And it was always Christmas, dude. It was always on. I'm sure this is not the case, but I can't remember like Empire and New Hope being on. I just remember Return of the Jedi. I don't know if like ITV had a syndication for it or whatever, but it always seemed to be on. And I'm sure they did. You know, I'm sure they did the others. And I do remember later on seeing like, okay, week one is New Hope, then it's Empire and whatever. But I feel like that was more like the 90s when they sort of started doing that, and they'd run them up through Christmas, and then you'd have James Bond doing the same thing. And the other standout for me, which I think we've got to mention at some point throughout this, because it probably stands out way more for this show, this movie, sorry, not only against the other movies in this audio series, but the other movies within the Star Wars saga, we got to talk about the toys at some point today. Because the toys were vital, because for me, this was another part of it. I had the Ewok, and I vividly remember having, can you remember the Emperor toy that, like it was sort of posable, like you could move his legs, but his legs were like the entire robes. They were just all plastic, one mold. There was no legs under a robe. It was like a plastic robe that was like, they were all movable as if they were his legs. So I sort of, they were the first elements to that for me. So it feels like a similar thing, you know, similar to a first exposure to sci-fi and or certainly for me to Star Wars. And it sounds like it's the same for you. Now, flashback to 1983, right? I'm going to hit you with some things. 1983, just for context, because I think it's really easy to forget what the heck was going on in 1983. We can sort of, I know we can say the numbers and we can say the words 1983, but we've got to truly appreciate how different the world was, all right? Scarface was released. The Outsiders with Tom Cruise, Patrick Swayze and Ralph Macchio was in there. Obviously, Return of the Jedi. We had Trading Places, Jaws 3, Never Say Never Again and Octopussy and bloody Flashdance, all right? They were the things that we were watching. From a music perspective, Phil Collins, You Can't Hurry Love, was number one.
Banger.
Billie Jean, Total Eclipse of the Heart, and the, We Can Never Escape Brent, Only You by the Flying Pickets.
Oh, man.
Was Yaz, right? Brabantos, right? It was Yazoo. It was Flying Pickets version that was number one. So, I mean, this is a different time, dude. Like, this is a huge time. And some of the biggest movie stars of 1983 were, like, people like Tom Cruise. You had people like Tom Selleck were in there. Rob Lowe. Obviously, Patrick Swayze, without a shadow of a doubt. Harrison Ford, without a shadow of a doubt. But then you start to throw in names that you just won't hear anymore. Of course, like, you got the Stallones and so on. But you've got things like people like Emilio Estevez, who, you know, I'm a huge fan of like Young Guns. I love Young Guns and Mighty Ducks. But like, he was a top star in 1983. So these were different times, mate. What were your sort of, when I said some of those names, when I said some, like, what were your memories of that? Can you remember like that era of the 80s at all?
Oh, dude, I don't remember those. I don't remember that specific year because I was only three, but I do remember shortly after that, once all of those things had been out of the cinema, et cetera, and then they started to trickle onto TV, like you said, at Christmas and home video and whatnot. So I remember those things sort of playing catch up, if that's the best way to describe it. So when those things like the Tom Cruise films and some of the early like Tom Selleck, like those things like Three Men and a Baby, I think it was, and those sorts of things. I remember seeing like a poster at the cinema when you drove past it for like Beverly Hills Cop or something like that, you know, and those early Tom Cruise films. So I remember being aware of them, but not knowing exactly what was going on because I was only three. But yeah, I remember shortly after that, sort of playing catch up as they landed on TV at Christmas and whatnot. And was there two James Bond films then in one year? Was it Octopussy and something else? Because that's mad. You'd never, well, have that
was now. That was like Bond, wasn't it? And just like to, again, just to add more context, right? Like, Stallone was the highest, literally the second highest grossing movie star on the planet in 1983.
What was that for then? Like the Rocky, was that Rocky's Rambo hadn't been out that long, surely?
Well, it was Rambo First Blood in 82 and Rocky 3. He was actually behind Harrison Ford for Raiders a couple of years earlier, Blade Runner the year earlier. And so there must have been trickle over. There must have been a lot of trickle over, right, from VHSs and for home video and all that sort of stuff as it was back then. But it's such a wild thing to consider. Like, this is pre-Ghostbusters, man. This is like pre-85 Ghostbusters. And that's wild to think, because you think, well, it's the same year, and it's pre-Predator, it's pre-any of that sort of big, you know, sci-fi was there, but it wasn't like it was in the 80s as we remember it. So what a wild time. So keep your hat on, 1983 hat on, all right? Maybe we should fast forward to when you were 4 or 3 and you could remember. But the beginning of the dark times, there was no Star Wars after this. There were a few comics, but basically we had to wait until the prequels for anything on screen. And then the Timothy Zahn novels in the early 90s that introduced Grand Admiral Thrawn for anything Star Wars-y. So, taking account all of that, assume you've just seen New Hope, you've seen Empire Strikes Back, you are a fan of those, you like them as you like them, but they're the only things you've seen. You go and see Return of the Jedi, you walk out of the theater, you've had your popcorn, you're nice and chilled, you know the end of the saga as it was then. What are you scoring this out of 10?
I think back then, with my 1983 hat on, if I was to give it a score at the time, I'd probably give it a 7 at the time. Just because I feel that you would have had that nice, cozy feeling as a kid watching that, the last 15 minutes of that film is very satisfying, knowing that back then George Lucas had no plans to do any other Star Wars films. So you were probably thinking at the time that was it. That was the very last Star Wars thing you were ever going to see. And so to have that whole redemption thing with Anakin and Darth Vader, and then the whole, you know, fuzzy feeling around the campfire with the Ewoks and the, you know, all that, it would have tied everything up in a nice bow. So you would have had that nice completionist feeling about it. And then preceding that, you would have had some really cool stuff, like the more scenes with the Emperor, which before that you just assumed he was this old evil wizard type of guy, and you were delving into Darth Vader a bit more. So I don't think it had as much whimsical, childlike fun as Empire Strikes Back. But I do think it was mature enough that, you know, at this point, like, your dad wanted to go and see it, definitely. It's like, it's sci-fi, son, you know, it's not my cup of tea with the first two. But then by the time this one rolls back, he's like, well, I'll take you, son, I'll see what it's about. So I think a 7, just based on that. And also, you got the feeling that it was... we were starting to get into event cinema at this point, I think, as well, because it wasn't like going to see, I don't know, like you said, The Outsiders. It wasn't like going to see like Risky Business or, you know, 48 Hours with Eddie Murphy and what's his face. You know, they were sort of good run of the mill, sort of all right films. But this was up there with like, this is the one to see. So you had to go out and get the other two on VHS, get them watched in preparation to see this one. So, yeah, it felt like we were venturing into that sort of red carpet, you know, big sort of event cinema stuff. So, and as you mentioned, as we get on to the end of it, I think the score's going to change a little bit. But for me, 83, a 7. Yeah, what about you?
Yeah, I think similar. Just because it would be easy to be differently scoring this, and I will get to that. I think as I'm walking out of there as a kid, and I don't know objectively that Empire is better and that A New Hope is better. you know, I just see this as, wow, lightsabers, Luke's good but looks bad, and he's looking at him as a Jedi now, and he's got his father back, and, you know, look, in space wizard. And I just, with all that, and the fact that Yoda dies in this, and the fact that Ben's back in it for a little bit, and you're like, that's his sister. I don't think 4 year old me, or 2 year old, or five, or whatever can remember, would have known that some of those things were a little bit like, oh, really? That's a bit of a stretch. So I actually think I would have scored it higher, you know. I think I'd have probably scored this at like an 8, 8.5. I'm going to go with 8, but I think I'm thinking of like 4 year old me that was, you know, a few years later, like wild about Batman 89. I think I'd just the spectacle of Return of the Jedi, I wouldn't have been as pissed off with the Ewoks. You know, like, why are they there? And, oh, we get it. Okay, that's why they're there. I'd have just been like, oh, cool, bears that do stuff. So it's sort of a weird, I'm trying to think of like child me, and I think I'd have gone higher. I think I'd have gone like 8 out of 10, but we'll get back to how we'd score it now. Cause I think it's, again, I think this movie stands out amongst the other ones in this season as potentially the one that will have the most movement in the scores.
Yeah. If it was child Gary, 3-year-old, 4-year-old Gary, then it's a 10.
Yeah, fair.
Just because of the spectacle, you know, and the, you know, you don't, it's almost a cynical thing to say, but watching Star Wars now, the age we are, it's like, well, Filoni didn't write that bit.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
It's like, it's probably George's influence, but you know, oh, I don't know. It's almost like a overly, you can't just sit back and enjoy it for the sake of it being Star Wars much these days, as much as you try. So I think back then as a little nipper, I would have been like blown away. I was thinking about if I was to transfer myself at this age now back, it would have been a 7. But as a kid, like dude, like 11, 12 out of 10.
Yeah.
Easy. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I get that. I'm going to put you down then for like an average 8.5. And we'll average, we'll say teenager Gary then. You know, I'll average your age now,
yeah.
Like 18, 19. All right, I'm going to stick you down for an 8.5, just because I do get that. All right, let's do a quick recap of the cast of this thing then. I don't think we need to spend too much time on this one because it's basically the returning cast of every Star Wars that had gone before it. Obviously, we've got Mr. Mark Hamill, the man, the myth, the legend. He's not a myth, he exists. The man, the myth, the legend, Mark Hamill's Luke. Harrison Ford, Han. We've got Carrie Fisher completing the trifecta of the original trilogy. Heroes as Princess Leia, and then we've got obviously Billy Dee coming back, Anthony Daniels, Peter Mayhew, we've got Frank Oz coming back, we've got David Prowse, Alec Guinness returning, James Earl Jones, Kenny Baker, of course. And then we've got Ian McDiarmid as the Emperor and Sebastian Shaw, both introduced for the first time properly on screen until the retcons later when they re-edited McDiarmid in as the Emperor and Anakin Skywalker respectively. And then we've got a few other people as well, like Wedge, coming in via Dennis Lawson and Admiral Ackbar and so on. There's a big cast to this one. But I think that's one of the things, I don't know how you feel about it, but that's one of the things that I liked about the original trilogy is that the cast was quite small, even though there was a lot of characters. Actually, the main cast was pretty small, wasn't it? It was like the big three heroes, Chewie, some peripherals, and then the baddies, and the baddies were the baddies, you know? So the cast was actually felt quite small, didn't it?
Yeah, it was like your little band of literally rebels doing their thing. And I don't know how you feel about this thing with buddy movies or groups of people in when I was young anyway, but I hated the thought of adding another member. I don't know what it is. It's like the introvert side of me, I guess, but I like, even now, like some things like that irk me a little bit, like Man. In the latest season of Stranger Things.
I get it.
When, you know, when Eddie Munson was a dude and he was like, is he going to join the group or whatever? And I'm thinking, no, he's not in the group. You're not in the band, dude. You're just even though he's a cool character, it would have been. So I don't know. Like, it just irks me when that happens. So the fact that they kept it very contained, the principal cast and stuff, that's one of the appeals for me. Yeah.
Yeah. I was sort of like that with like the Karate Kid movie, like Karate Kid 3 and even 2. I was like, who's this girl? Like, what? Where's the other one from the first one? Like, did they break up? Why? What's wrong with him? He's fine. Look at him. He's cool. He's a karate guy. Why do you not love him anymore? Like, yeah, I totally get that, man. Because, yeah, and it's... I don't want to go down this path because I think we'll spend forever on it, but we'll get to this on sparkrebellion.com if you're a Star Wars fan. But I think that's one of the challenges with like the sequel trilogy, isn't it? Like, they just didn't bring the unit back together, and that was a swing and a miss. But yeah, it was quite interesting. I mean, the cast, I think worth mentioning is like Alec Guinness as old Ben Kenobi. You know, he was a little bit like, you know, I've got to take this for the brass in A New Hope. And then he keeps coming back, you know, he's sort of in the biggest film ever. And then suddenly he's like, yeah, you want me back for Empire? What? I'm coming back as a ghost. Like, I know I hated the wizard stuff. I know I hated that, but you want me back as a ghost? Yeah, this time I'm in. You know, that's sort of I always think that's quite an interesting change of heart. And I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I just feel that that's sort of looking through a certain lens of cynicism. That's a bit like, of course you're going to come back.
Yeah, I don't know if this is true or not. It's one of those things that you've read over the years, but I'm pretty sure that Alec Guinness had some kind of monetary payout from the rights of Star Wars. I think, you know, when he agreed to sign on, because let's be honest, this could have been an absolute disaster, that first Star Wars film. And if you've watched any of the documentaries about the making of it, it was coming close to being just an absolute write-off. So I think for some security, I'm pretty sure he had wrangled, like, I don't know, certain percentage, only a small amount, but, you know, enough to be like six figures or seven figures a lot. But so I'm wondering if he did the same thing, even just to appear in a couple of small scenes in the other two. But yeah, to play a ghost, like, yeah, I'll be a ghost for a little while. I mean, I'm knackered because I am literally old Alec Guinness. So I'm not, you know, I'm not back flipping around with a lightsaber, but yeah, you know, I'll come and chill with Luke for a bit. Yeah, sounds good. Cup of tea.
You want me to sit on a log?
On a log.
Go on then. You've got me.
With a cup of tea.
You had me sit.
Yeah. And let's be honest, the lines in those scenes where he's a Force ghost, they're not exactly, we're not talking like, you know, Shakespeare, you know, it's like, what was it, 2 minutes on screen, 3 minutes tops? So easy money for the old Guinness.
Oh, yeah. Easy. Well, that actually leads me on. I want to talk about the high points and the low points. We're going to go through the high points to start with of this movie. Which bits of this stood out and still stand out for you?
Yeah, so I've got a few high points. So two of them I can rattle through really quickly because they're quite obscure. But the first one for me is seeing a new thing in Star Wars. And I'm not basing this on the very first time that I watched it as a wee lad. I'm just talking over the years. Is seeing the Imperial Guards in the Death Star. I don't know what it is about them, but you know, they kind of riffed on that design in the sequel trilogy. We had the Praetorian Guards and whatnot. There's something about those characters that are so interesting and so cool because we know nothing about them. You can, if you go on Wikipedia, and I'm sure there's like stuff in books and whatnot that explains a little bit more about how you become an Imperial Guard. One would assume that as a badass stormtrooper, whatever, you're like, you know, they're holding trials to be an Imperial Guard or whatever it is. You have to try out whatever. I don't know. But the fact that we knew nothing about them. And their design is amazing as well. All that red, you know, that was a color that was reserved for like the baddie side of things. Like the black and red has always been the baddie stuff. So that was cool. The second thing was talking as a lad. The second thing was were the Ewoks. So that was kind of weird to me because back then as a lad, I'm talking about things like Terrorhawks, the Dark Crystal, those kind of things, you know, that whole, what's his name? The guy that did the Muppet stuff.
The Henson.
You know who I'm talking about. Yes, the Jim Henson stuff. So growing up with that kind of thing, Ewoks to me were in a similar ilk to that. It was very much at the time I didn't view it as like these annoying little, you know, furballs, as, you know, a lot of people consider them to be. I just thought they were really cool, like very, very cool. And then the third thing for me is, you picked up on it earlier, is a real standout moment is Luke, Mark Hamill's performance through this entire film. Because, again, switching, going back through time to now adult Gary again, his performance in Empire Strikes Back when he has to act alongside a puppet, for me, is one of the best things that Mark Hamill's ever had to do, and is just amazing. Mark Hamill's performance, to me, makes Yoda's performance in that film. You know, Frank Oz and that whole thing, brilliant, the puppet effects, but it's just Mark Hamill. So when you come back and you see him a little bit older, and you see him a little bit wiser, and a little bit more as that powered up Jedi sort of thing, you're rooting for him throughout the entire film. And that scene towards the end where, in the Emperor's throne room, where he can see out the window, that the fleet is walked into a trap and everything's going to shit. And you think, don't do it. You're almost shouting at the TV. You're like, don't do it. Don't reach for the lightsaber. He's baiting you he wants you to get angry and stuff. So don't, Luke, don't do it. And then he shows that relatability to all of us and that vulnerability. So as an adult, for me, it's Luke throughout that film. Then there's like obviously loads of other high points, but those things for me, when I think about Return of the Jedi, is like, yeah, they bring a smile to my face every time, dude.
Yeah, I think the Luke thing's important. That would be up there with mine as well. I think the peace, yet the quiet confidence and sort of power that he's got as well, which is sort of like it's by one token demeaned a little bit, but by another token strengthened a bit by the whole prequel idea. You know, this idea that Jedi are trained really young and it takes him a long, long time to get mega. And he's just like, yeah, I did it in 3 years, mate. So, you know.
Completed it, mate.
Finished it. So it's sort of a, you know, it's like, does that cheapen the Jedi training, or does that just show how powerful he is? And it's, you know, you can read that in different ways, especially when you add all the other context of Anakin and the Skywalker lineage and all that kind of good stuff to it. So I have to admit that Luke is a big standout for this one. I also, for me, this is related to that, a big high point was like that big set piece at the beginning. You know, it starts off with the confidence of Luke going in and saying this is your last chance, but it's really the barge scene where he's, you know, he's got the plan. It's all pulled together and he's very supremely confident in that. And it's just, for me, that's sort of, it's the first time Luke was like swashbuckling. It's the first time he was like the James Bond of Star Wars, where he was able to go in and he'd had the plan. He'd got R2 there and it was like a little gimmicky. Oh, the bloody lightsaber's in there. Didn't know R2 had a pocket there. And so all that kind of element of Luke, the tactician that we'd not seen. We'd seen him as an ace pilot and moving through to be a commander in Empire and then obviously a nascent Jedi, but we'd not seen him be the Jedi. You know, we'd not seen him be the Jedi. And then I think as a complete, you know, the complete juxtaposition record to that is you've got the Emperor. There was another high point for me. It's like the first time McDermid was in the robes properly. It's the first time he was. And that guy just oozes sleaze in this role. He just oozes the fact that you just think, you absolute ass, you total awful piece of crap. You know, you just hate the guy from it. And that's such a testament to McDermid. You know, it's like Teabag, the actor that played Teabag in Prison Break. You're like, you hate the guy. And like, he's got to be really good for you to hate him. So those two really played off nicely against each other. I would say that they're the high points for me. There's obviously a lot of set pieces. There's the Han and Leia stuff. There's a lot around, you know, the way that the story unfolds and the twists that it's a setup by the Emperor and all that kind of stuff. I like, you know, that's all very good stuff. But they're the standouts for me because it's all character. It's all just character stuff because that gave the springboard for much later. I think Luke's a big one. Now, we are going to talk about some high points and we're going to talk about some more low points as we go through this one. But just before we get to that, let me tell you about this.
Hello there.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Spark of Rebellion.
If you are enjoying this episode, I have absolutely no doubt that you will love our sister show, Spark of Rebellion. With news, views, and a little bit of comedy, it is your weekly dose of everything Star Wars. And it's intended to keep busy people like you and I up to date with everything happening in a galaxy far, far away. Of course, it's available in your podcast app of choice or at sparkofrebellion.com. All right, let's wrap up a little bit of the high points for me. Another high point we've got to discuss is seeing all the creatures and all of the effects. I think, personally for me, guys, I don't know how you feel, but seeing the scope as a kid of like, oh my word, look, Jabba, and he's moving. It was sort of took the Yoda thing and like amplified it. How did you feel about seeing, like, was that a high point for you, seeing all this come to life a little bit more? It felt like the world had got a little bit bigger in Star Wars.
Yeah, as I think we're going to come on to, I don't want to talk too much about visual effects. Are we coming on to that, are we? Yeah. So in terms of bringing the world to life and stuff, yeah, you can tell that was just a thing back when, because nowadays you kind of expect it with every film, especially things like the Marvel Universe and DC and even the newer Star Wars stuff. There's a very high bar, you know. So in terms of world building and how things look and stuff, you expect it now. But back then, you really only got to that point if you had the bunts, you know. So you could tell that on the success of the first two films and all the merch and toys and whatnot, Lucasfilm had some serious coin. So at this point, creature effects were better, visual effects, which we'll come on to. I'm not going to talk about that right now. And then you had just things like costumes and weaponry and stuff like that. So yeah, I enjoyed very much so seeing the more of Star Wars, because we flit to and from in a few places as well, don't we? So Luke goes back off to Dagobah while the fleet goes off to do this, and then we're on the Death Star, and then there's a whole thing that you mentioned on Tatooine with Jabba at the beginning and stuff. So yeah, it's in terms of feeling like it's a larger world compared to the other two, it definitely felt that way. And yeah, the puppet effects and whatnot in my head, I think we've been talking, I don't know about you, but I've been talking about the original release as well, not the re-release, like the Blu-ray and the special editions and whatnot, because the visual effects and everything are all fairly different in those. But yeah, and I think probably the best thing that Star Wars has pioneered as well, and what works really well, and you mentioned, is the puppeteering and stuff. So we had Yoda in the last one and a little bit in this one. And then that Jabba puppet and stuff, that's a real achievement, I think, for filmmaking, because now that would be like, if anyone's seen the original Blade film with Snipes, there's a scene where they go into this vault thing and there's a massive big fat blobby vampire thing, and that's done all visually and stuff, and that's the last time I can think of like a big oversized big ass character like that that's done live action. It's all CG now, so you know, big puppets like that. I'm not talking about little puppets like the little Ewoks and some other little ones. I'm talking about like big space occupying things like Jabba and stuff. So yeah. Yeah, I would say it is a high point. Definitely. Yeah.
All right, let's go to low points. I'm going to just pick two of these ones, actually. I'm going to go with some of the dialogue being clunky. You know, like you alluded to it, you know, what I told you was true from a certain point of view. And you're like, oh, get out. Like, that's a get out of jail card. And I'm a huge Star Wars fan. I'm a huge mythology fan. And I really want George Lucas to have had the idea for the prequels, like properly had the idea for the prequels and Empire and Return of the Jedi all planned out. But he clearly bloody didn't. Like, let's be straight. He absolutely did not. That's not to take away anything from him and the talent and the vision. But when he did Star Wars, he did not think that was going to happen in Return of the Jedi. Not a chance. Not a chance. So that's the dialogue for me is a little bit clunky off the back of that. I think it's just sort of all right, let's get past that one. And I think another low point for me, dude, is the wild underuse of Boba Fett and the weakest death in all of Star Wars, only to be supposedly sorted out later in the Book of Boba Fett, which I know we've got opinions on, but I could pick a few more, but those two for me are really the, I can wash over them because I enjoy the movie. There's nothing in this movie that stops me enjoying it and stops me watching it. But they're the ones that just make me think, did we need to? So what about you? What are your low points of Return of the Jedi?
Yeah, I think I have to agree with some of the dialogue. And I'm not sure if that is a directly related to George Lucas thing.
Yeah.
The thing that makes me think that it might be is because some of the dialogue is equally as ropey and wooden in some of the prequels.
Yeah.
And I know that was George Lucas's writing as well. So although this was a Lawrence Kasdan thing predominantly, you do get the feeling that certain scenes and certain lines were a little bit George Lucas-y. So, yeah, I would go with that, dude. Another low point is some of the visual effects for me. And that might sound weird because they are more progressively, you know, upped in quality and whatnot from the other two, you could arguably say, but I've got an opinion on that. I think we're going to come to that in a second. And then another low point for me was once you get through two thirds of the film, so you've got through the whole initial thing with Jabba and then you go through the middle, you know, part where Luke's gone off and they do the rest of it. It would have been cool to have seen, I feel like it was wrapped up a little bit too quickly for me, because what I would have liked to have seen was the stuff happen with Luke and Vader and everything, maybe 20 minutes before that. And then after that scene, because the only thing you see really is after that stuff is Han getting the truth about Luke and Leia being brother and sister and all that stuff. And then the little happy, you know, dance and sing song around the fire, and that wraps it. So from one point of view, yeah, it wraps it up in a nice little bow. It's all good. But the thing is, knowing that we weren't going to get anything else after that, we don't know what's happening with the characters post Endor with the Ewoks, you know? So we don't necessarily need to know, but it would have been nice to have seen, right, okay, Han and Leia go off to do that thing. What's Luke up to now? You know, what's his next plan for whatever, you know? So even from a storytelling point of view, and a lot of films used to do this, coincidentally in the 80s, it was a thing to do, is you left the door open just a little bit. You left the door open for certain characters, for a sequel somewhere down the line, whatever it might be. But they didn't do that at all. They just closed the whole thing off. So for me, it wraps up a little bit too quick after that final battle on the Death Star. And we don't really get... So as George Lucas, with that kind of financial foresight that he had, you would have thought that he would have put a little bit more in the closing part of the film to sweeten people for a bit, like even if he had no plans to, like throw in another droid on Luke's base, whatever he's doing, that's another toy you're going to sell, you know, throw in, do you know what I mean? So that's a potential low point. It's just a wrap up for me.
Yeah. I hear that actually. That's quite interesting because a lot of films did do that. They'd, you know, they'd show the hand coming out of the lava or the, you know, they'd show the, are they really dead? Whoa. And then they might never get a sequel, or they might get a sequel. And yeah, that's an interesting point actually, because there's so much they could have done. I sort of respect the idea that any other stories featuring the original trilogy people would have then just been fresh stories. But then that sort of annoys me more about the sequels, because it wasn't. And then, it's a great point actually, dude, because then it makes you think, well, would the dark times within Star Wars literature and media have been such dark times had there been a little nugget, you know, because there may have been a thread to pull on. So perhaps, man.
Yeah. And however much we crack on the sequel trilogy and, you know, go and listen to some of our SOR episodes for that stuff, but you can't deny that the ending of The Rise of Skywalker, however crap it might be, it does leave the door open because she buries the lightsabers. And you think one day she's going to go back and get them, or someone's going to find them. Do you know what I mean? So it's not a confirmed, yes, there's going to be a sequel involving these lightsabers that she's just buried, but it does leave the door open just a little bit. So now, you know, a billion authors over the next decade can write some cool stories around that stuff. So, but that's what they didn't do with Return of the Jedi. But, you know, you get why. Yeah.
Yeah, you do, man. You do. Well, actually, so you mentioned the special effects, and you are way more versed in this than I am. You've got a better eye for it. You study it a lot more in your own time. So let's talk about the effects. You know, let's talk about them as they were back then in the original release, and then just some of the tweaks and the changes and generally how that's all aged. So what are your views on the effects, man? I know this is really something that you enjoy.
Yeah, the effects, it's a funny one with this, and I don't think it's isolated to Return of the Jedi. I think it's just a movement within the industry at this time, in the mid-80s especially, where we kind of had this shift from having effects that were very practical. So if you think about some of the early stuff that ILM did for A New Hope, I think the first bunch of takes that they sent over, I think George Lucas was just like, no way. Like, we're never using that stuff. So I think they scrapped a load of it. They're a year behind, whatever. But then they sort of pull their socks up. I think in today's terms, it's known as crunch. You know, a lot of video game studios do this where the deadline's looming and then you end up with people doing like 100-hour weeks and all that stuff. So I think, but however much that's shit for people working at the studio, I mean, some people thrive on that, but however crap it is for people, there's no doubt that sometimes it produces great work. And that's the stuff that you can see that's evident in A New Hope. By the time we get to Return of the Jedi, it feels like they've hopped on this bandwagon of using this style of effect, even though they know it looks cheap, but they still do it because the industry's doing it, you know? And what I mean by that is it's like rotoscoping over the film stock. So in Return of the Jedi, the best example that you see is when Leia goes up to Han, who's still frozen in the carbonite at Jabba's palace. She whacks some controls on the side, and then as he thaws out, the effect is like this red glow, right? That's over his body, and it just looks bloody awful, mate. And then there's another one. There's another scene where they're having the lightsaber battle in the throne room and stuff like that, and it all goes to shit for Luke. The Emperor gets involved, and it's the classic lightning out the fingers, you know? So I'm aware that back then there was no other way to do it, but I think it's more stylistically, the way it's produced makes it look so bad, but they were just doing it because loads of other films are doing it. I think the worst example of it that I've ever seen is the Masters of the Universe film. What year did that come out? I think that was late 80s, right?
It's got to be. I reckon it was like 85-ish. I reckon that was earlier than you think, or like maybe 88, 89, actually. Let's Google it.
Yeah.
Oh, man, yeah. What a movie that. I can't. Oh, it's 1987, right? I officially cannot wait until 2027 because that shit's going in.
Yeah, so that film, however great that film is from a nostalgic point of view, it's just literally scene after scene of that type of effect. And I'll tell you what it's like. There's no substance or depth to the effect. It's like this very 2D painterly style effect. And like I said, the best example is Han thawing out. So for me, however much I love the effects in terms of creating the atmosphere and the action and bringing it all to life, it just doesn't feel as authentic as the previous films, especially A New Hope. A New Hope, I can't even think of a scene where it has any of that weird stuff in it. Like, it was just all models, all shot on live action cameras. Yeah, and it just has this cohesion that's just, there's no disjointed thing. Like when you go from seeing those guys in the cockpit of the Falcon approaching the Death Star, so then the outdoors shot of the Death Star going into the hangar bay. Yes, you can tell it's a matte painting by, you know, the guy, you know, the concept artist for Star Wars.
Chang.
What's the guy's name?
Not Chang.
What's the guy's name? How can we forget his name? One of the triangles. One of the points of the triangles of success. Ralph McQuarrie. Bloody hell, dude.
Big Ralph,
even though you can tell it's a matte painting, yeah, by Ralph McQuarrie, it doesn't break the realism aspect of it at all. So yeah, that's my thought on the VFX or the SFX, dude.
It's a funny time in movies as well, because it's sort of, I think A New Hope benefits from that practical nature, because there wasn't even the possibility of doing that much else. And you sort of go through the 80s into the 90s. You know, a good example of it for me as well is like Terminator, where a lot of it is, most of it is practical stuff.
Yeah.
And It's you sort of now, you don't even mind that it's dated, because you just think, well, it's practical. Of course, that's not Arnie's head. That's a Henson head or a... it's a puppeted head. That's okay, because that's what they had. And I think when you flash forward to like 91 and you've got T2, like T2 would have been such a different story had they not done such a job on the effect. Because even now, that, yes, you can see there's some of the depth when you blow it into 4K, some of the depth on the effects is off. But holy crap, when you were watching that on an old CRT screen at like 480p resolution or even less than that, 260, whatever, that was badass, man. And that stood up for such a long time. And T2 could have been such a different film had they gone this way. And I feel that it was just a symptom of the times, wasn't it? Almost like CGI in the prequels was a bit of a symptom of the time. And now we fast forward up to the Marvel era and everything that we've got in Star Wars, there's still some dodgy CGI, like some of the Logan stuff that we saw a few years ago in one of the Wolverine films. Like, it's still crap. But for the most part, it's actually really good. And it's a shame that we had to go through that and some of these movies suffered because of it. Let's just have a quick second on some of the updates then. So some of the Lucas changes. Where do you sit on that train, dude? How do you feel about the Lucas changes, the inevitable last couple of rounds of tinkering?
I'm always, my mind changes on this all the time. I'm 50-50. There's a purist aspect of me and that thinks that they shouldn't have messed with it at all. Like, there's one thing, cleaning up the picture a little bit, remastering the audio for a good surround mix. There's one thing doing that. But even that's failed terribly. Actually, dude, this is so weird that you mentioned Terminator 2, because that's been mentioned a lot this week. You put it on Twitter the other day. You picked up the soundtrack, right? The Terminator. And I think when I was looking through Sky last night, we just finished watching something, ITV4 last night, Terminator 2. And
nice.
What a film, right? Yeah. Which is coincidental. Now I've just mentioned it again on this podcast. It's so weird sometimes when it happens. And the version that they put on TV last night was this horrific version that they released the first time round on Blu-ray, which they just went nuts with the DNR. And everybody looks like they're made of wax, and it's just freaking horrible. So even that can fail sometimes. But there's that aspect of it where you're just doing, like, let's bring this up to speed so we can at least make it look and sound like it competes with modern day films somewhat. But when you actually go and change characters and even, you know, even some of the placement of characters and what's going on in certain scenes and the lines of dialogue, you know, it's just, that to me is, I feel like it's unnecessary a lot of the time. If Star Wars was a flop, right? If George Lucas was like an out of work, you know, director and producer, has not been up to much and thought, you know what, if I mess with a Return of the Jedi a little bit, that could come back and we could make a few bob from that, then I could understand that. But the fact that everyone's already double, triple, quadruple dipped and bought that film on various formats over the years already, to go back and then mess with it again, I don't know, man. It just feels weird, like the rationale to do that. But there are a few changes that are pretty sweet. So things like the Rancor, things like the Sarlacc pit with, you know, that whole scene around Jabba's palace, that actually looks pretty sweet now. So those sorts of things where it sort of enhances the, especially in that scene where it enhances the threat level, because before it just looked like a hole in the sand with a few claws in it and, you know, it burps every now and then, and, you know, it doesn't look like intimidating enough due to the budget at the time. But now it looks like this actual creature, you know, it looks like it has a, it's actually operating sort of, you know, it's not an autonomous thing. So changes like that, I can get on board with, you know, if it's going to enhance the experience of a scene, you know, and it provides a little bit more whatever, then fine. But for me, like, you know, the whole, not just in, is it in this, when, not just in this film, but like when Vader screams no, you know, at the end of Revenge of the Sith, you know, to add that in. So those sorts of things, you know, I'm not on board with that stuff. And I think the biggest unnecessary change in Return of the Jedi for me is the whole Max Rebo band thing and the song, you know, that
in it.
To me, having a song in Star Wars is kind of, yeah, I get it to a degree, because it's like, you know, the kids love a bit cliched, but the kids love it, you know, and, you know, it's a quirky thing, and I get it. It's very, very quirky. So that was one of the things that people said was pretty shit anyway. So why would you take that scene and just make more of it? It's a bit like, you know, it's a bit like when you've made a bit of a boo-boo at school, you know, the teachers ask you a question and everybody hears you say the wrong answer. And instead of just letting it go and, you know, carrying on with the lesson, you then just like, no, I've got the right answer now. And then you get it wrong again. And then everybody just laughs a little bit more. It feels like that with that scene. So yeah, that one for me is like a big, like, why did you do that? It's awful to now double awful.
Lucas and his blooming tinkering, eh?
Oh, exactly.
I get it. Yeah. It's weird, isn't it? Because it's, where do you stop with it? And I'm not, you know. It's a funny situation with the Anakin thing at the end. You know, Sebastian Shaw gets swapped out for Anakin Skywalker from the prequels, Hayden Christensen. When, if you watch this movie or the OT original trilogy in isolation, you've never seen Anakin's face as Hayden Christensen. And so for me, that's sort of a, like, the completist in me loves that, because I'm like, that's Anakin back. It's the Anakin that we know. That's his back. Look at him. It's the good guy. Remember him? He was mint. But then if you're just watching the movie in context of the movie, you're like, who's that guy? Who's that? Who's that chap there? So there's a lot of, for me, it feels like, you know, Max Rebo and all that sort of stuff notwithstanding, it feels like there's some of the changes that were continuity based in that particular thing. Stands out from that perspective. You know, okay, we've done the prequels now. We're trying to tell a saga story now. Here's the deal. But it's a funny situation, which leads me on to the last question. We're going to do our ratings as if we'd seen it today. So how do we rate it right now? But before we do that, we're just going to wrap up with a little bit of a sentence or two, my man, from you on just how do you think this movie has aged overall?
I think it's aged fairly well, to be honest with you. I think it's one of those films where, even if you don't watch, if you've got it on some format that's reasonably old, or if you download one of the various sort of fan edits that are quite popular that sort of strip out some of the special edition stuff and makes it a bit more sort of true to release. Even if you watch it on some of the older formats, not in high res or anything, I think it still holds up, purely because, well, for me, it's two things. The first one is it's just a great film anyway. Even if you were to take out the low points that we spoke about, it's still a really good film in its own right, regardless if you consider it as part of a trilogy or a saga, whatever it is. It's really, really enjoyable from many, many aspects. And then the second thing is that the performances from some of the cast members almost make you just not give a shit about some of the other lower points in it, you know. So yes, some of the visual effects feel a little bit like of its time, which I guess the special edition try to sort out a little bit, but you know, I think I think people of our age don't mind that anyway, just because of our age. You know, we grew up watching films like that. So A, it's normal to us, and B, it kind of strokes the nostalgic niceness. You know, we're watching these sort of things like we all get with that sort of thing. As a good example is the official YouTube channel for the old Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the original cartoon. They've just put the entire season on there for free. So I watched through the first two or three episodes of that, and the animation is bloody awful, like proper bad. But you don't care, because when you were a kid enjoying it, you were a kid enjoying it, and that was it. So going back and looking at these things from those perspectives, you know, it does, you can sort of allow things to sort of pass by that you wouldn't with modern day films animation that come out now. So yeah, I think it's aged reasonably well. I think, and I don't mean to beat the same drum, but it's just some of those visual effects make it look a bit dated, whereas conversely, A New Hope doesn't look as dated. So yeah, but overall it's aged reasonably well.
Yeah, I agree, man. There's some great examples of that, like the Masters of the Universe film that we mentioned earlier. Yeah. Like, I love that film. It's shite, but I love it. You know, and you can tell they ran out of budget at the end because all the lights go off for the last fight and it's just clashes of light and swords. Like, they literally ran out of budget. So you're like, holy crap. But I'm all right with that. You know, I mean, plug your Korg in, right? Get your Korg in, get your amp out, play your little song, your keyboard. Yeah, open another dimensional portal. Yes, I'm in. No resemblance to He-Man, but fuck it, this is brilliant. And it's like, it's even like Back to the Future 2. The effects are shocking. But you're just like, yeah, this is mint. And you sort of give it a pass. You give it a pass because, like, no one's annoyed at Terminator. So I get that, mate. Like, it's not trying to be anything. I'm with you on that one. Right. We're going to stick a pin in it. But before we do, this has been a fantastic episode. I'm going to wrap up with getting your score, my friend. To recap, if Teenage Gary, as averaged out by Small Gary and Big Gary, had stepped out of the theatre and having watched this in context of A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, you would have given it, well, you would have given it like a 12 out of 10 as a kid. But, you know, we'd average that out about an 8.5 or a 9 out of 10. Today, you go to the cinema, which I did actually for the 40th anniversary, which is pretty badass. You go to the cinema, you go and watch it, you've seen everything Star Wars, you've watched everything, you're ready for Ahsoka, you are excited about seeing Hayden Christensen back, you've watched Obi-Wan, you've watched the prequels, you've seen the sequels, you've done a rewatch of Rebels. You know everything that you know about Star Wars and about cinema now. You step out, you've just watched it, what do you score Return of the Jedi as of today?
Score it a 9.
A 9.
Yeah.
All because right. Why is that?
Yeah. Very quickly, just because there's no getting away from the fact that George Lucas cast that film perfectly.
Yeah. I get that.
So with A New Hope, everybody who was involved at 20th Century Fox were like, what are you doing? Like, these nobodies that you've cast, this is a failure sort of thing. And, you know, they had to sort of put a bit of trust in him. But what a decision for those. So the principal cast absolutely make Star Wars what it is, without question. Yes, you can look at the whole John Williams thing and the Ralph McQuarrie thing and all the people that were instrumental in making it what it was. But as you go through that original trilogy and you see the character progression and you see the performances, that is just Star Wars. And then you wrap it all up with the high points that we've mentioned. So for me, dude, it'd be a 9 walking out of there. Yep.
Interesting. Do you know, I thought this might move more than anything else. But the more we've talked about it, I think I'd stay the same. I think I'd stay at an 8. Because there are better Star Wars films. But how much of the stuff that's come after it has been better than Return of the Jedi? Probably not that much. And especially recently, we're leaning more into Luke from that era, and we're getting literature around Leia and Han from that era, and I think we're going to get more of that, frankly. So, I don't know. I feel like, I thought it was going to change more. I thought we might go down because new stuff has come out. But I struggle to think of anything that's of the same ilk in Star Wars that is better than Return of the Jedi. So, for example, like Andor, you could say, well, it's better or it's worse, but it's not. It's just different. Rogue One, it's not. It's just different. And it's... So I can't... Like, the only other things that you've got to compare it against really are the other saga films, the prequels, the sequels, and the OT. And I just... Maybe outside of Revenge of the Sith and maybe Force Awakens.
Force Awakens.
Mm. Yeah. Does anything else come close to an 8 out of 10?
Not particularly.
I don't think so either.
And also the thing about Return of the Jedi is that it's got really, really good stuff from start to finish. Whereas something like Rise of Skywalker or Attack of the Clones, whatever, they're busy films, but nothing really happens in large chunks of those films, you know, whereas, yeah, especially the OT films and this in particular, there's consequence to everything that's happening. And do you know what I mean? But there's like, there's big shit going on and there's a lot of substance to it. And there's a lot of weight to what's happening in each act as you move through it. Whereas, I don't know, like 25 minutes in, half hour into something like The Rise of Skywalker, I'm looking at Instagram and Twitter and that kind of, you know, I don't really have that with the OT films, you know. But apart from Revenge of the Sith, that kind of falls into this nice formulaic bucket that we have with these original trilogy films. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought we were going to go down as well. Yeah, I thought we'd go down a bit. Yeah.
I agree, man.
I love it, though, mate. I love it.
Yeah, I'm happy with that. Yeah, I do as well. I think the more you talk about it, the more you realise that it's just a very solid entry in Star Wars and sci-fi overall. I love the Vader redemption stuff. I mean, we've not even talked about the music, but it sort of doesn't, for me, it didn't warrant it just because it's John Williams. It's Star Wars is Star Wars. You know, you'd have been better placed talking about the music if you were talking about A New Hope, I think, because it was fresh. Mm. It almost goes without saying that Return of the Jedi has the same themes. A couple of new ones, but actually, generally speaking, because it's the same characters, the same cast, the same everything, it's the score's like 85% the same. So it's it feels like that's never going to get old. Like that will always be great music, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a couple of standout tracks, but I think he'd already covered off the main themes in the first two films, like the Imperial March for Vader and the Empire stuff, and Yoda's theme. The Force Fiend theme for Luke, those kind of things. And I think there's one for Leia as well, which is like softer and whatnot. And other than that, it's just these big bombastic sort of themes as you go into sort of, you know, there's a really cool track called Into the Trap, which is very, very cool. Other than that, yeah, it's just, but yeah, it's great music, but I think it already covered off the big hitters, you know, up to that point. But yeah, it's John Williams, isn't it? Superman soundtrack's really good as well, dude. A lot of people say it sounds almost the same, but it's not, is it? Definitely not.
No, it's that big fifth interval, isn't it? That's all it is. That's the big thing. It's, I get it. Mm. I get why people think it's similar, which, I mean, that's what you want, though. You know, if someone says to you, come up with a march that's going to make you feel good, that's what you do. You do that big jump. You do the same interval. But Drew and I spoke about this, just to wrap up but as a slight digression. And that's what they did so well in Man of Steel. Like, don't rewrite the Superman theme and steal anything. But then they managed to, by using the same interval, the big fifth jump that made it feel familiar enough, where you're like, this is Superman and it's hero stuff. And you've got no idea why, unless you're a muse, or it's just the same interval. And so there's a lot of that in soundtrack, you know, the big da 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 da. That interval's always there. So, which is quite fascinating. But we could talk about this forever. We'll probably do a soundtrack episode at some point. I would have thought of It's How Old. But that has been Return of the Jedi. If you've enjoyed that, of course, you can get more by just taking a look at the podcast app that you are listening to this very episode in. You are going to find episodes in Season 1 for not only Return of the Jedi, but The Dark Knight, Superman the Movie, Man of Steel, and Jurassic Park. You don't need to listen to them in any order, but join us in celebrating some of pop culture's biggest birthdays. Gaz, always a pleasure, my friend. And for anyone listening out there, they can catch you over on sparklerebellion.com for a weekly dose of Star Wars, can't they?
They can indeedy. Yeah, we talk about all the we deep dive into way more stuff than this for the old Star Wars stuff. So do that, and thanks for having me on, man. It's I love the premise of this show, mate. It's all good, so thank you very much. I love you and I love the show.
I love you. I love the show, and I also love your other show. Go and check it out, guys, if you're Doctor Who fans. The Big Blue Box Podcast, the UK's premier Doctor Who podcast, so do check that out as well. Until the next time, keep on loving what you love. Thank you so much for joining us here on It's How Old to celebrate pop culture's biggest birthdays. Enjoy the rest of this season.